Happy early October, and this is the voice of your host, Nick Deolius, for the podcast known as The Far Middle. This episode, like all Far Middle installments, will certainly be unique in its own special way. That's how we roll on this podcast. And we have a small handful, a trio to be exact, of connections this week, and they tie together into a common theme. What's the theme? I suppose that's going to depend on your perspective. Some might call the theme belief in self. Some may call it confidence bordering on overconfidence. And others may consider the theme to be a rebel obstinance in the form of unconventional thinking. But what you will see in our three connections that display this week's theme is that they, the connections, can bring it, the theme, to manifest in the individual in ways that have an enormous outsized impact on his or her field, or even with respect to history. And I'm going to warn you at the episode start that the outsized impact can be a great thing or an incredibly tragic thing for humanity. And we will have examples of both within our three connections, which span an incredible wide spectrum of sport, world and military history, and the arts in the 20th century. Let's get started, and I can show you what I speak of. Our sports dedication provides the first example and starting connection of episode 176's theme. Dedication goes to an interview from the mid-1950s by, without a doubt, one of the five greatest baseball players of all time, and perhaps the greatest all-around baseball player in history, and that would be Willie Mays. Now, some of you Far Middle longtime constant listeners might be saying to yourselves right now, hey, wait a minute, Willie Mays was already a prior Far Middle dedication. And you would be correct. However, our dedication this week is not specifically to Willie Mays as a player, but instead to his interview in 1954 and to what it exposed as the mindset and the relationship between star athlete and his professional sport back in the 1950s. Quite different than what you see today. And what you will find with our dedication interview is a publicly humble athlete, perhaps a naiver athlete when it comes to the business side of things, but nevertheless quite a self-confident athlete who did it his way, not the conventional way prescribed by the experts or coaches. Willie Mays, in that 1954 interview, he was giving that to prepare for to be included in a book. The book was titled The 1955 Mutual Baseball Almanac, and one of its co-authors who compiled the book was the legendary sports writer Roger Kahn. The almanac consisted of a series of interviews with notable players of the day, discussing their views of the game, their careers, and tips for aspiring professional baseball players. And it is a surreal time capsule when you read it today. The wholesomeness of the 1950s comes out loud and clear across all of the interviewees, as well as the content of the interviews. Willie Mays and his interview, they were no exception. Mays said that there were three things that were vital to becoming a successful professional baseball player. The first and most important in his mind was to love the game, because if you didn't love the game, you were never going to be driven to learn and excel at it. The second vital factor was not drinking alcohol, because it would deter the professional athlete's performance on the field. Basically, Mays was advising youngsters to live a clean life off the field so that you could excel on the field. Drugs weren't even contemplated as a concern back in 1954. And then the crucial component number three of a successful pro ball player from the perspective of Willie Mays was to get the right amount of sleep. And that meant not too little and not too much sleep. For Willie Mays, the perfect time of sleep was 8 hours every night. If you sleep more than that, he felt that you got lazy. And if you slept less than that, he felt it would hurt your performance the next day. Mays then discussed the driver that was making him a better player each year. He attributed much of his improvement to accumulating playing experience. For him, there was nothing more valuable than playing time to hone his craft, and I might add, to increase his confidence. And he used the example of his trademark basket catch, that unconventional approach he developed to catch fly balls in the outfield, as a great example of how playing time yielded better performance. He started to develop and perfect his basket catch technique during spring training, where he would catch the fly ball at waist level instead of the conventional way of holding the glove at head level or above your head. And the experts and the conventional thinking, they told him that what he was doing was wrong, frankly, almost insane. But he saw it as a superior method because it helped position him better for a throw to the infield. and he kept practicing the basket catch technique. He perfected it. He became confident in it. And then he ended up ignoring the conventional criticism and bucking the trend. And that led him into another key insight during this interview. He was at the mindset that you can take all the instruction in the world from an expert as to how to do something, and it would not amount to much when it came to being able to actually do it. The only effective way to become good or exceptional at something, from Willie Mays' perspective, was to do it yourself over and over, learn by doing, and basically making mistakes. The mistakes get corrected, the technique gets refined, and before you know it, you're better at the technique than you would have imagined at the start of your journey. I mentioned that Willie Mays could also be self-confident in things to the point of being naive. And that might have been a case when it came to his relationship with the owner of the New York Giants at the time, Horace Stoneham. He considered the owner of the club a friend and someone who had his best interest in mind and someone to be trusted at face value. People at the time would advise Mays to try to hold out for $50,000 in salary for a season. Now imagine that, the best player in the game shooting for $50,000 in annual salary. But Mays refused to hold out because he trusted Stoneham and considered him his friend. But he did acknowledge in the interview that baseball, in the end, was a business. In his view, if he declined to hold out coming off of a good year, then the partnership, so to speak, between him, the player, and them as management, will build some political capital and goodwill, so that if Mays were to have a poor season down the road, Giants management would return the favor and not try to reduce his salary. Now, he never had to test that premise because there was no such thing as a poor season when it came to Willie Mays with the Giants. Despite being humble, Willie Mays was a proud individualist. His idol when he was a young player was Joe DiMaggio, but he didn't try to play like Joe DiMaggio. Mays believed strongly that you needed to develop your own style of play, is evidenced by his development of the basket catch technique. Check this out toward the end of the interview from Mays, which sort of sums up his approach nicely. Quote, "But it all comes back to what I said in the beginning. You got to love the game. Nobody can teach you nothing, not me or nobody, and nobody can write a book that will teach you. You got to learn for yourself, and you got to do it your own way, and you got to become much improved. If you love the game enough, you can do it." End quote. Willie Mays and his mindset in 1954, confident, self-assured, learning by doing, and at times perhaps being a bit naive. Episode 176 is dedicated to the mindset of the professional athlete in the 1950s, a much simpler time. Willie Mays showing self-confidence, self-assurance that resulted in excellence in his field. Let's make a connection to another example of self-confidence and self-assurance, but in this instance, leading to epic, and I mean epic, human suffering and historical tragedy. We're going to discuss a root cause as to how Adolf Hitler became the self-assured monster that ended up haunting history till this day. It's a story most don't realize, even many World War II history buffs. I think you're going to find it fascinating. Historians always critique Hitler's arrogant belief that he knew better than his generals when it came to military strategy and tactics. His views that ran counter to the consensus of his generals, and they proved to be right before the start of and early during World War II. So he astutely played the United Kingdom and France, knowing that they would want to appease him, and he used that to consolidate Germany's footprint on continental Europe. He cut a deal with Stalin to divide Poland up upon the dual invasion from east and west. He took on France and vanquished it using the tactics of Blitzkrieg, and then the stunning and early successes of Barbarossa with the invasion of Russia. And early on, every time Hitler's generals advised for one path, it seemed his approach was simply to ignore them and pursue an altogether different path to stunning levels of success. We know that all changed as the war unfolded, much to the detriment of Hitler and Germany, and much to the benefit of the free world and allies, but after a lot of devastation. But there's a backstory that explains why Hitler was so confident and self-assured when it came to deciding military strategy and tactics. And that backstory helps explain why he didn't hesitate to chart his own course and ignore the advice of what was perhaps the best trained military leadership in the world, to the point where he was tragically naive in his assessment of his own ability. It traces back to Hitler's experience during the First World War. Hitler referenced his First World War experience as, and this is using his words, the greatest of all experiences. And it also showed how his individual interest was subordinated to the common interest. The makings of the Führer in World War II can be found in the trenches of the Western Front during World War I. Although Hitler was Austrian, he volunteered for a Bavarian German regiment. He petitioned the Bavarian king for permission 3 days after the outbreak of the war, and he was granted his wish. The regiment he was assigned to was filled by recruits that were untrained, just as Hitler was himself. And he found a high level of camaraderie with his fellow soldiers. And they went through a horrible experience in the fall of 1914 that became known as Germany's Massacre of the Innocents. It was when Germany rushed replacement reserves that were still in training to the front lines, one of which was Hitler's. This was around the town of Ypres in Belgium, and Hitler and his comrades were facing veterans of the British Expeditionary Force. When the German conscripts with no frontline experience attacked the British trenches, they were massacred. Hitler's regiment consisted of 3,600 men. Less than a week after the attack, only 611 survived unwounded. Hitler's regiment, over the course of the war, lost over 100% of its paper strength, which, by the way, wasn't uncommon for either side during the First World War on the Western Front. Hitler's company of 250 men had been reduced to 42, and he was promoted to Lance Corporal and was recommended for the Iron Cross Second Class. This was Hitler's introduction to total war. The fact that Hitler survived this meat grinder, it's amazing in and of itself. Alternative history scenarios would endlessly toy with the concept of what if he didn't survive the First World War trenches. How might history have been different? Even more amazing is that Hitler survived despite having an incredibly dangerous job in the army. All his fellow soldiers testified to his bravery and personal courage. He was held in high esteem by those who served alongside him in the First World War. The general who commanded his regiment wrote of Hitler's, using his terms, exceptional pluck and the reckless courage with which he tackled dangerous situations and hazards of battle. Hitler earned a tremendous level of respect as a soldier in those trenches. His duty was that of a messenger. And in World War I on the Western Front, that was not a job that you would want if survival was your objective. The messenger or runner was an uncommon risk. He was under constant fire because he would be running between battalion headquarters and the front line, always in a line of fire or exposed to artillery. And since communications would be dispatched around a clock, there was no downtime for the messenger or the runner. Hitler himself summed it up quite well when during one battle he remembered, quote, during the first day of the attack, three of us 8 runners were killed and one badly wounded. Yeah, that type of an experience was repeated over and over for a young Hitler. Constantly exposing himself to heavy fire to deliver messages ultimately earned him an Iron Cross First Class. He earned that by volunteering to run with a message calling off German artillery fire that was falling on his own trenches and killing his fellow soldiers. The citation that went along with the Iron Cross commented that, quote, Hitler has shown cold-blooded courage and exemplary boldness. He has always volunteered to carry messages in the most difficult situations and at the risk of his life, end quote. Hitler was wounded multiple times during the Great War. His most serious injury was a bullet or shrapnel wound to his thigh that required 5 months of recovery. But back to the front lines he went in October of 1918. He was injured during a British gas attack. He was blinded but still managed to carry a dispatch back to battalion headquarters from the front line. Hitler was a student of his craft. He was always looking to improve. Most runners, they just trusted fate and left their destiny to luck. Hitler studied trench maps intensely, which were constantly being updated. He was always trying to work out the safest route to achieve the objective, which was very similar, interestingly, to how Willie Mays approached fielding techniques and how he studied pitchers to get better. Now, when you fast forward to World War II and Hitler's testy relationship with his generals, you can begin to understand why he felt that he knew more about the war than his generals did. Not only did Hitler experience the war up front and personal during the Great War, but he also considered that his high proportion of his generals at the start of the Second World War had either been staff officers or artillery gunners during the First World War. In other words, in his view, they were in the rear while Hitler was at the front. they were the elite removed from direct exposure, while Hitler was with the commoners in the trenches. In fact, as generals during the Great War, they weren't exposed to the risk that Hitler had been exposed to because their military gifts were thought to be too precious to risk in the mayhem of the trenches, whereas a common soldier like Hitler was viewed to be quite expendable. From Hitler's perspective, his generals weren't able to fully comprehend the reality of war because they never experienced it directly like he did. I suppose Hitler viewed the elite of German military as something to oppose and to always view with skepticism. The generals he started with were replaced with others as World War II unfolded, and those new generals were often more in line and consistent with Hitler's views of those who knew war firsthand. Rommel, the Desert Fox, is a prime example of such a general, having commanded troops in active combat and on the front line during the First World War. Indeed, much can be gleaned from Hitler's First World War experience that explains quite a bit when it comes to his Second World War decision-making, particularly the confidence he placed in his own judgment and the distrust that he placed upon his military leadership. It's a reality that's missed by, as I said, many historians who focus on the Second World War, and perhaps in part because it requires acknowledging Hitler's bravery during the First World War, and it's naturally uncomfortable to be speaking of the bravery of an individual who ended up being one of the greatest monsters in human history. But that is representative of the complexity of our species. And it was shocking to me when I was preparing this episode to see some of those similarities on approach between two people I would never link together, Willie Mays and Adolf Hitler, for goodness sake. How in the world could a vibrant, universally loved, all-time baseball great have anything in common with an individual whose evil resulted in the deaths of millions upon millions of innocents? It seems illogical, but then go back to Willie Mays in his interview on his approach to becoming a great ball player. He didn't listen to the traditional thinking or the expert coach. He experienced and watched things firsthand. He experimented on his own with refinement and improvement, and then he developed his own thinking, approach, and technique toward the game, which led to great, incredible things. Hitler, meanwhile, he also was unafraid to challenge the conventional wisdom of the military elite. He felt he knew war better than they did because he experienced it firsthand in the frontline trenches. He developed his own thinking and tactics toward war, which led to horrible, incredible things. Sometimes the greatest among us and the worst of the human species, they share some things in common. And understanding the nature of that overlap, I think it can help us fortify the greatest and avoid the worst. Now, I said there were three connections that tie into this week's theme of confidence, self-assuredness, obstinance, and bucking the conventional wisdom. The third and final one is found in the field of music, country in particular. And I can be even more specific than country because this man was a founding father of the outlaw country music genre. His name sort of fits the genre, Billy Joe Shaver. Wait till you hear his story. Shaver was born in Texas, raised by his mom. His mom worked at a local nightclub where he was first exposed to country music. Shaver left school after the eighth grade to help his uncles pick cotton. He joined the Navy when he turned 17, and upon discharge, he worked a series of dead-end jobs, including trying to be a rodeo clown. He met and married his wife, Brenda. They divorced and remarried several times, so that looked to be an up-and-down relationship. And Shaver took a job at a lumber mill to make ends meet. One day, his hand becomes caught in the machinery, and he loses the better part of two fingers, and he contracted a serious infection. He recovered, but he taught himself to play guitar without the missing fingers. Now, I was impressed with Black Sabbath's founding guitarist Tony Iommi playing guitar with part of just one finger missing. I saw a photo of Billy Joe's damaged hand, and he is missing most, if not all, two fingers, his index and middle finger. It's unbelievable he could play guitar like he did. Shaver set out to hitchhike to Los Angeles. He couldn't find a ride west, so what's he do? He jumps to the other side of the highway, and he ends up heading east when he caught a ride, and he accompanied a man who dropped him off just outside of Memphis. His next ride brought him to Nashville, and there he found a job as a songwriter. His songwriting came to the attention of another founding father of country, Waylon Jennings, who filled most of his album, Honky Tonk Heroes, with Shaver songs. Those two met, you'll love this one, in a travel trailer at Willie Nelson's 4th of July picnic. I wonder what they might have been smoking at that picnic. One can only imagine. Other artists, Elvis, Kris Kristofferson, they began to record Shaver's music. And this led to him getting his own record deal, although he's never able to gain widespread recognition as a singer. But he never stopped recording his own music. And on his records, you're going to find him being accompanied by other major rock and country musicians. You got Willie Nelson on some of his records, Dickie Betts of the Allman Brothers, Charlie Daniels, just to name a few. In the late 1990s, in 1999, Shaver performed at the Grand Ole Opry. That was sort of a career summit. Now, Bob Dylan, the legendary Bob Dylan, he mentions Shaver in his song, I Feel a Change Coming On. The lyrics from Dylan in that song, I'm listening to Billy Joe Shaver, and I'm reading James Joyce. Hey, when Dylan cites you in a song, you are a legend. Comedian Norm Macdonald was an avid Shaver fan and a friend, and praised his songwriting. And artists, you know, including the aforementioned Dylan and Elvis, along with Johnny Cash, they've all recorded his songs. Not bad for a guy who described himself as unmanageable. Now, Willie Mays was an example of how our theme of self-confidence and bucking the tradition, how it can result in greatness. And Adolf Hitler was the example of when those attributes might manifest in epic evil. Billy Joe Shaver, he was a more complicated situation of our episode's theme at work. On the good side, it helped him birth a genre of music. But there was a dark side to this independent thinker and unconventional personality. Because back in 2007, police in Texas, they issued arrest warrants for Shaver on charges of aggravated assault and possessing a firearm in a prohibited place in connection with an incident outside of a bar, Papa Joe's Texas Saloon. That sort of sounds like the type of place Billy Joe might frequent. Shaver shot a man there 2 days earlier before those arrest warrants in the face with a handgun. And the victim's injuries, however, were not life-threatening. Now, to me, I hear shot in the face. That sounds life-threatening to me. But, you know, Texans are known to be a tough breed. Anyway, witnesses interviewed by police report hearing Shaver say to the victim, "Where do you want it?" And then after the shot was fired, "Tell me you are sorry, and no one tells me to shut up." Years after the shooting, in an NPR interview, Shaver said that he shot the victim because he was such a bully, using his terms, and that, this is from Shaver, "I hit him right between a mother and a," I'll leave the last word for you to figure out. Then he said that was the end of that. He dropped his weapon and said, "I'm sorry." And I said, "Well, if you had said that inside, there would not have been a problem." Oh, can't forget to mention that he was acquitted of these charges in a Waco court after testifying that he acted in self-defense. And his friends Willie Nelson and actor Robert Duvall were in attendance for support at the trial. Texas-based country musician Dale Watson wrote a song about the incident titled "Where Do You Want It?" And Shaver recorded his own song about his incident and trial. He titled it "Wacko from Waco." We lost Billy Joe about 4 years ago. And I hope that you enjoyed the episode theme this week, bringing together three people who I'm fairly confident have never been connected before. Be self-confident. Buck the conventional wisdom where you see an opportunity to break new ground. Learn and improve by getting in there and doing. But always make sure you do all those things with a steady moral compass that keeps you connected to that far middle.